Okay, so on the 33rd episode of the Loopcast, I have Andrew here, who's gonna we're gonna talk about jihadi movements in North Africa. So when we're about 2, 3 years removed from the Arab Spring, and it's with political change, there's always moderates, extremists, and then I think today our conversation is gonna focus on sort of the more extreme part of, the Arab Spring and sort of the jihadi movements that have cropped up post Arab Spring. So let's start with your article that you published today in Foreign Policy, Confronting Tunisia's Jihadists. And I'm kind of fascinated because, we did a conversation with David on Tunisia's Islamists. And so walk us through, the Tunisian jihadi movement. What is, what's its relationship to Tunisia as you sort of saw in your research? I mean, is it something that sort of is rebelling against the Tunisian order, or does it see itself more transnational and more sort of, a local affiliate of Al Qaeda? Help us work us through this.
Sure. I mean, after the revolution in Tunisia, you saw a tremendous opening to Tunisian society. And obviously, that extended to a number of areas. One of those areas was, of course, religion, in terms of people being much more free to practice, in terms of people being free to come and go, but also in terms of people being released from prison. Ben Ali, the former Tunisian dictator, imprisoned, it was upwards of 1,200 people, if I'm remembering the number correctly, on terrorism charges. Some of those people were involved in jihadi movements. Some of them were just Salafis. Some of them were also political prisoners. There was a mix of people who were all put into prison after the Tunisian anti-terrorism law of 2003, who were many of whom were released in 2011. And so you've had just a lot of change and a lot of disruption in religious life and religious practice in Tunisia. One of the key changes has been the emergence of Ansar al-Sharia in Tunisia, headed by Abu Iyad al-Tunsi, who is a longtime Al-Qaeda fellow traveler, I think you could call him. He founded the Tunisian Islamic Combatant Group, was close to bin Laden, helped organize and sent two men to Tunisians living in Europe who traveled to Afghanistan to assassinate Ahmad Shah Massoud in 2001. So you have someone with a very long history of jihadist activity who was also released from prison. And so he started Ansar al-Sharia. Now, what was interesting about AST, as Aaron Zelin has laid out quite clearly, the first or one of the first to really do some in-depth research into this and talk about the kind of duality of Ansar al-Sharia in Tunisia, that they pushed dawah activities and charity activities in Tunisia and then emphasized jihad outside of Tunisia. So it's been one of these debates about Ansar al-Sharia is, do you call them a Salafi jihadi group or not because of this kind of split mentality? And so that made things very challenging. Now, we've seen a fairly high level, a growing level of vigilante violence, of religious violence in Tunisia, and also political violence, which makes it hard to disaggregate sometimes who is responsible for what. But with the September 14th attack on the U.S. Embassy in Tunis, which many people in AST was heavily involved in, and then with the subsequent search for Abu Iyad, who's gone into hiding as a result, you've had this, as I detail in the article, increase in tension between the Islamists and the Ennahda government, who have been accused in the past of not doing enough to confront Salafi violence and Salafi jihadi violence and Ansar al-Sharia. And so that has been growing. In the article, I look at this particular jihadist group Katibat Uqba ibn Nafa, and they have been operating, and AQIM is believed to have been operating in Tunisia for several years, since 2011. We have reports of supposed AQIM involvement in the movement of weapons in Tunisia. And what's different about this, and what's, I think, brought this discussion about jihadist groups in Tunisia a bit more to a head, is, as I detail in the article, incidents that started late last month when Tunisian security forces started hitting homemade mines in the Shembi Mountains near the border with Algeria. And so there have been 16 Tunisian security forces injured so far. Five have had legs amputated. They've begun a very intensive search for this group, members of whom are believed to be linked to Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, but also to Ansar al-Sharia. So that's where we are right now. What's interesting about this, for one of the interesting things about this for me is, you know, for years, and certainly between, you know, 2006, 2007, and then 2011 or so, the thinking on AQIM in particular really was that AQIM had failed to integrate North African jihadist groups, you know, into its new movement. You know, AQIM has its passes as an Algerian jihadist group. It was the Armed Islamic Group in the 90s that splintered, and a faction became the Salafist Group for Preaching and Combat. And then that group, the GSPC in French, became AQIM. But again, there were some Tunisians, there were some Moroccans, there were some Libyans within AQIM, but the group was not really successful in integrating these jihadist groups. But what we've seen recently is not just an increased willingness and increased AQIM presence in different countries in the region, but also we are seeing more North Africans within AQIM, especially Tunisians. And that is a very interesting change, especially coming at a time when we've seen a large number of Tunisian fighters going particularly to Syria to fight Bashar al-Assad's regime.
So before we get into the more regional and more sort of AQIM in general, I'm curious then, you know, how has the Tunisian government dealt with sort of these Tunisian jihadi movements? You know, you did point out that, you know, the use of mines has sort of merited, I think in your article, you pointed out that after the use of mines, the Tunisian security forces have gone after, you know, these jihadi groups. You know, in your research, do you think that the security forces have been successful, or do you think that, you know, really they haven't, they really haven't been successful in the pursuit of these jihadi groups, and, you know, it's really something that it's hopefully going to be regulated to this one part of the country in this one area? Or is that, you know, what is the security forces, what is their broader strategy or policy regarding these jihadi groups?
Well, security forces have complained in past incidents about not having clear directives from the government, about the government not being willing to take on these groups, explicitly jihadist groups, and also Ansar al-Sharia, though, as I said, there is kind of an ambiguous relationship, an ambiguous understanding of these groups and their orientation. You know, the military has, with this most recent series of incidents, the military has arrested a couple of people. They announced today that four arrests, though it was unclear if they were members of the group currently somewhere in these mountains and also to the north, or if they were people who were linked to them, who were bringing them support in one capacity or another. But so far, they really have not been able to track these fighters down. Now, one of the big questions is, you know, is this, these two groups of fighters, one in the Shembi Mountains, one to the north in Kef, you know, are they the only ones, or are there others spread out in other parts of the country? So that's one question. And then the other question is, you know, as I said, there's been this increasing tension between the government and Ansar al-Sharia. And so, as Aaron Zellin has pointed out, has argued, things are starting to come to a head between these two groups, especially after Ennahda leader Rashid Ghannouchi announced that AST would not be able to hold its annual conference in Kairouan. And so AST has announced that they're going to go ahead and hold the conference anyway. And so there's a real potential for violence or for increased conflict around the conference, depending on what the authorities decide to do. And there's also a risk if the government truly decides to crack down on AST, that you'll start to see increasing radicalization among people who maybe would not have been involved with certain kinds of violence before. Because remember, again, AST, at least publicly, has emphasized that Tunisia is not a land of jihad. And if the government were to more aggressively crack down, I think for a lot of people that that could change. And Abu Iyad has implied in relatively clear terms that that's what would happen if the government decides to crack down further. So we're at, Aaron calls it a tipping point right now, and I think that's a very good way of describing it.
So what are the sort of origins of, you know, jihadist violence? I mean, it seems like you make this point in your article that really, you know, this jihadist activity is sort of recent, and that, or you say that, you know, and it seems like, as you point out in your article, that since 2011, this sort of violence and this sort of activity has skyrocketed. You know, can you point to, you know, the origins of this? Is this really just sort of, you know, sort of conservative elements in society sort of railing against democracy, or is this, you know, evidence, do you see this as evidence as, you know, networks, you know, sort of, you know, arms trafficking networks, drug trafficking, you know, people moving from, you know, from Libya, from Mauritania into Tunisia to sort of spread the idea of jihad? I mean, what are the sort of, you know, the underpinnings or the origins of, you know, this sort of violence in Tunisia?
Well, I think you've had in the past, you've certainly had fairly significant Tunisian involvement in past jihadist conflicts in the 90s, in Iraq, and you've also, there have been attacks in the past in Tunisia, though the most notable of those, the Djerba synagogue attack in 2002 was organized by Al-Qaeda Corps. So you do have Tunisian involvement in jihadist activities in the region, in Europe, in the Middle East. What I think has changed is really, as I talked about this opening of the political scene, which has given way to not just new political ideas, but also pressure groups. And so you do have groups that are trying to enforce their ideas through violence, through intimidation. You also just have a more open, uncertain environment that people can take advantage of. So that could be as a pressure group, that could be individual groups of people trying to institute their own version of Sharia or trying to enforce certain moral strictures. For instance, we see this with people attacking bars or attacking art exhibitions, as we've seen in Tunisia. So some of this does come from the kind of general or more general ferment of ideas and also the unrest we've seen in Tunisia. Some of this, I think it would be fair to say, comes also from cross-pollination of groups, from different groups potentially moving into Tunisia, from Tunisians traveling elsewhere and coming back. And also, I do think we have to take into account the influence of people who were jihadis, who were imprisoned under Ben Ali, who were then freed, people like Abu Iyad.
So let me sort of pull back and sort of look at the bigger, the regional context. You know, how has, you know, where can we put the, you know, these Tunisian movements within the broader context of, you know, what in the West we call, you know, Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, AQIM. You know, what's the context, the larger sort of context for these movements in the larger regional context, I should say, for these movements in Tunisia?
Well, the broader regional context, I think, is certainly that AQIM has been operating in a changed security environment in the last 2 years, with the uprising in Libya and with the overthrow of Gaddafi. Certainly, we have seen weapons pouring out of Libya, though I think their impact potentially has been overstated or not quite correctly stated in certain parts of North Africa and the Sahel, though they are absolutely playing a role. But with increased political upheaval and with the rebellion, the Tuareg rebellion, and then subsequent collapse of the state in northern Mali, these groups did have increased space to operate. We know of Tunisians traveling to northern Mali. We know of Tunisians also participating in attacks like the Enemies gas attack, a gas plant attack in Algeria in January, participating in large numbers alongside AQIM fighters under the command of a recently called a dissident AQIM commander, though I think it's a bit less clear than that, Mokhtar Belmokhtar. And so in this upheaval, AQIM has been able to seek greater operating space and has been able to potentially deepen its connections or make new connections with other jihadist groups, with groups located in areas like Libya, and has been able potentially to seek out new sources of revenue, of weapons, and of men.
So I'm curious then, how much does the, I think you've written a previous article, I think this is you, and I apologize if it's not, but about the drug game in North Africa, and sort of walk us through, you know, how has trafficking contributed to the spread or, you know, of AQIM? Because does trafficking still play a big role? Is, you know, drugs and guns, you know, sort of the financial underpinning of the spread of AQIM, or, you know, where do we put the sort of criminal and trafficking element in all this?
Well, you know, all insurgent groups to one extent or another profit off of illicit economies, right? And because funding is difficult if you're outlawed.
Right.
AQIM, you know, people talk about this a lot, and people talk about AQIM's connection to trafficking. Very famously, Bill Mokhtar is known as Mr. Marlboro and is often derided prior to the In Amenas attack as being much more of a trafficker than a jihadist. This is something that people said about AQIM more broadly for years. And they did make money off of trafficking, though I think the common understanding is much more that they sometimes provided protection for trafficking networks, tax trafficking routes in cigarettes, in drugs, so not just cocaine, but also hash, and that they made some money off of that. The estimates I've heard, at least prior to 2011 and 2012, were that AQIM made the bulk of its money from kidnapping for ransom rather than from trafficking. And, you know, without access to classified information, it's very, very difficult to know. I don't pretend to have a good answer for what their financial breakdown was. It did certainly benefit from trafficking to some extent, and also absolutely benefited from weapons trafficking. But again, it's important to put this in context because there are reports for years of AQIM using money derived from kidnapping for ransom, money derived from trafficking, to invest in weapon systems and sometimes to invest in heavy weapons. And AQIM possessed an array of heavy weapons before the crisis in Libya. So it's important that these weapon systems were on the market before Libya. What I think happened as a result of Libya is the prices of weapon systems dropped. We've had many more weapons available, though again, it's unclear, at least for the moment, how much of that made it to Mali. It's quite interesting because in a recent small arms survey report, they looked at documented weapons in Mali. And this is kind of a basic report for the moment, because if you can't get to the north, if you can't physically document these weapon systems, it's very difficult to try to trace them back to their origin. But many of the weapons they saw could have come from Libyan stocks and could have also come from Malian army stocks. And that is, I think, an important thing to emphasize, is that weapons circulating in the region did not just come from Libya. They also came from other sources, from other conflicts, and also from armed forces in the region, either losing weapons to theft and defection or from corruption and people selling weapons to traffickers, to jihadist groups. So there's a diverse array of criminality and black market and gray market activities that kind of converge in this environment.
It's interesting. So, I'm curious then, you referenced the war in Libya, and you sort of walk us through, has the war in Libya and then sort of French intervention in Mali, where does that fit into the narrative that, let me walk that back. What is the narrative of AQIM? Does it see itself as a sort of transnational group that, seeks to, impose its vision? Because it seems like, at least as a layman, the sense I get that is that, the Tunisian branch seems to want to go against, authorities in Tunisia. The Mali branch seems to, resist authority in Mali and so forth and so on. So I'm curious then, is AQIM truly transnational, or is it more, a very local, but sort of local across three or four countries? I guess that could be transnational, but would you consider this a true sort of, what is their narrative? What do they view as their ultimate goal? Is it, oh, go ahead.
Well, I think AQIM is a diverse organization, like many organizations. When you're talking about the Tunisian branch, Bab El Nafi has been identified as the Tunisian branch of Al-Qaeda. It's also been identified as linked to AQIM. I think we don't really know enough at this point to say definitively. But so on the one hand, you have AQIM, which is joining Al-Qaeda, placed itself within the context of global jihadist movements with the immediate goal of integrating Salafi jihadi movements in North Africa into one and creating this Islamic Maghreb, going as far as reclaiming Andalusia, Spain, and sort of reclaiming past territories and spreading Sharia, spreading Islamic law. Within that, you have factions, and you have now splinter groups, most particularly the Movement for Oneness and Jihad in West Africa, Mujahid in French, who have stated that their goals are much more focused on the Sahel, on West Africa, on spreading Sharia, spreading jihad in these areas. So I think we do have slightly different or more regionally focused goals, roughly with the same or with very similar orientations. This is why there's a paper written about AQIM, I think in 2007, that first talked about AQIM as a global organization, so one that speaks globally, thinks globally, but acts locally. And I think that has endured as a very good way to conceptualize a lot of AQIM's activity, but also a lot of militant activity that we're seeing now increasingly in the Sahel and in West Africa, in addition to North Africa.
So how does the sort of intervention in Libya and the French intervention in Mali, how does that play into their narrative? I mean, it seems like, you know, how does it, I mean, how does that play into their narrative? Is it, does it fuel this sort of anti-Western sort of trend, or is it more, is it something they just sort of ignore and not talk about? I mean, how does this, how do these two, you know, very recent interventions play into the narrative?
Well, I think Libya was a bit of a difficult situation because with the intervention in Libya, you really had France, NATO coming to the aid of Muslims who were being killed by Gaddafi's forces. In Mali, that was a bit more clear-cut for jihadis in that you saw, at least online, much more of an immediate reaction to the Mali intervention as being a case of foreign Western intervention in Mali, as explained very recently in a video from an AQIM official. So you did see, a much more uniform jihadist outcry about Mali, though that dissipated fairly quickly. You do still see, I think, a fair bit of jihadist interest in Mali, though not quite as much as kind of the height of the occupation and then after the French intervention in January. But Mali has been, I think it's fair to say, an important issue for jihadism. You've seen statements from other al-Qaeda affiliates and from other jihadist groups not in the region about Mali.
So let me sort of switch gears a little. You know, where do you see sort of Western policy? You know, it seems like, you know, do the French consider AQIM a sort of a CT threat? And, you know, besides the sort of the intervention in Mali, what has been the, you know, France's policy against AQIM? Or, you know, what have been their movements against AQIM? Is it, I mean, you know, is counterterrorism in Africa sort of elevated to the level of counterterrorism here in the United States? I mean, is this something that sort of occupies French strategic thinkers?
Well, AQIM is a very large priority for France, in particular because looking at the Francophone Sahel, this was an area under French colonial rule, and it was under French colonial rule. It's an area of intense economic interest for France, especially in Niger, and also French investment, French cultural presence. And so it is just a part of the world that is very important for France. And AQIM, at the time of its founding, was very clear that one of the reasons Al-Qaeda accepted AQIM was in the hope that it would attack France, attack French interests in the Sahel. You know, the predecessor group, one of the predecessor groups to AQIM, the GIA, staged multiple bombings in Paris in the 90s. GIA hijacked an Air France flight from Algiers, who we now know was likely intended to crash into the Eiffel Tower, though that was disrupted in Marseille. And AQIM has staged a series of attacks against French interests in the Sahel, both attacks and also kidnapping of French citizens. And so AQIM is certainly a priority for France in terms of counterterrorism, though France has taken, I think, a less overt kinetic approach sometimes than the United States has. France works very closely with some local governments on intelligence sharing, on training, but at the same time, there are French special forces in the region. There have been French special forces and French equipment and French aircraft in the region for several years now on a much more of a combat footing. And French special forces have intervened multiple times in Mali to attack AQIM groups, and also specifically in one case in January 2011 to try to free two young Frenchmen kidnapped in Niamey. So it's a bit of a mixture, I think I would say, though. In general, you don't see quite as much of the overt counterterrorism presence as you do from the U.S. and other places, though that posture has shifted with the French intervention, with the French military intervention in Mali, which obviously was a very significant kinetic effort in large part to push back and hunt down AQIM and affiliated groups.
Interesting. So, I mean, you know, we mentioned the CT, but I mean, sort of, you know, does France have more sort of economic, you mentioned targets and you mentioned sort of the hostage situation that was at the gas plant, is it?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, sort of outline, I mean, you know, does France have a deeper sort of economic relationship with the region that seems to be parallel its sort of CT efforts? I mean, those two efforts, the economic and the CT, are they sort of, do they go hand in hand or are they sort of considered separate? You know, in the sense that, you know, in the United States, the sort of, you know, we consider nation building to be, you know, not just the military side of it, but also investment and development. I mean, is there a similar attitude in France, or is this really, you know, the CT element is on one side of the room and the business interests and the investment is on another side?
Well, I think it's always difficult, or not always, but it's sometimes difficult to separate concerns, you know, security concerns related to national interests. So on the one hand, you do have just a counterterrorism threat and a threat of attack in France and against French interests, whether they be people, government installations, or businesses. On the other hand, obviously, you have a larger economic interest where France is concerned about instability in the Sahel. It's not just a business interest there, but you can't argue that that economic interest, business interests, and kind of fundamental national interests don't play a role in decision-making processes for France when it relates to the Sahel. I mean, uranium from Niger supplies a significant amount of uranium that goes to power French nuclear power plants. So uranium in Niger, resources in the region, are a strategic national interest in France. And that is intertwined with security concerns, many of them related to jihadist violence in the region. So they do overlap quite significantly.
So for my last question, This has been sort of gnawing at me, and I think it's because when my girlfriend, she's coming back to the United States from Africa, she stopped in Senegal. And in Senegal, I think they basically deboarded the plane and did a huge drug check of the plane. So, which, I mean, it's drugs, it's, you assume it's there, but I'm curious, in the broader picture, where do we put Senegal? Like, is this, it, you know, do they experience the sort of same trends that we've talked about? You know, is there a Senegalese jihadi movement? Is there a Senegalese? I mean, where do we put Senegal in all of this? Because it just seems like, you, as a layman, as somebody just, you know, a casual observer, you would assume that Senegal, as a part of Francophone Africa, as part of, you know, they would sort of be involved in this in one way or the other, but you never hear about it. And I'm guessing most of the research papers on Senegal are written in French and what have you. So, you know, walk us through it. I mean, is Senegal somewhere in this, or?
There are some American researchers and academics who focus in Senegal who've written really great stuff in English. Senegal is an interesting case because Senegal politically is quite stable. Last year, Senegal underwent relatively peaceful political transition. There was election violence, there was violence in the run-up to the election, but at the same time, it was able to go through a political transition. Senegal is interesting. Senegal, in the post-independence period, has not had a military coup. which kind of sets it apart from a lot of other countries in the region. Senegal has increasingly been home to a number of businesses who operate in West Africa, NGOs. You know, if you drive around Dakar, you see so many NGOs, so many large international organizations that have regional headquarters here, and also businesses. And, you know, at the same time, it's interesting that you brought up the question of drugs, because a lot of money flows through Senegal and through Dakar, and there are no good numbers that I've seen, but people do talk about a significant amount of money laundering in Senegal. There are drugs coming through Senegal. There are counterfeit cigarettes and smuggled cigarettes coming through Senegal. And so that has certainly had an impact on the local economy, especially in recent years, along with the influx of NGOs and international organizations. With regard to militancy, that's also a bit of a difficult question. Senegal has a very strong, there's a very strong place in Senegalese public life for religious orders. They're very, very important in Senegal. At the same time, people have remarked a kind of slow, low-level growth of Salafism in Senegal. There's a history of activism, political activism linked to religion, and some more hardline reformist movements, especially in the last 30 years. Alex Thurston, who runs the really excellent Sahel blog, has done research on this in the past. With regards to jihadist movements, there is no Senegalese jihadist movement per se that I know of at the same time. There are Senegalese officials in the last year have on multiple occasions expressed concern about sleeper cells in Senegal. There have been reports for several years of Senegalese in AQIM. And when I was in Mali, I personally heard reports from people who were in northern Mali during the jihadist occupation of the north, who said that they saw Senegalese fighters coming into northern Mali. So I think it's a relatively low-level issue, but that kind of radicalization does exist to some extent in Senegal.
So for my last question, to bring it back to our beginning, you know, what does this say about, you know, the Arab Spring? I mean, has the Arab Spring been sort of positive for Northern Africa, for the Maghreb, or do you see this as more, you know, is it a positive thing, is it a negative thing, or is it more something that is, you can't really, it's not really positive or negative because there's, you know, there's good things and, you know, sort of bad, you know, has the Arab Spring been, you know, a positive thing for Northern Africa?
Yeah, this is a debate you hear people in the U.S. having a lot, and honestly, I find it very problematic, because on the one hand, yes, you do have some increased security problems. Certainly in Libya, you have tremendous security problems. Do you have an increase in vigilante violence in Tunisia? You have the after effects of weapons flows and of increased freedom of movement. At the same time, you know, it's not for me to say as an American whether or not decisions by, say, Tunisians or Libyans or Egyptians to rise up and seek political change. You know, it's not for me to say whether that's good or bad. You can debate something like the intervention in Libya and whether or not that was a good strategic decision for the United States. But it's not for me to say whether or not someone else's choice to, you know, to seek political change was a good or a bad thing. I think it is a good thing that people have the opportunity to seek more representative government, more political freedom. But it will, you know, we'll see how this develops in the years to come.
Definitely. So before we end, you know, I like to, the last comment is always the guests, you know, whatever, you know, you want to give a roundup comment or general comment. Did we miss anything? You know, the last comment is yours, basically.
Well, thank you for having me. And I would just want to say, you know, it's been good to see more coverage and more attention paid to this part of the world, though it's unfortunate that so much of it comes because of security issues or because of radicalization. My hope, I would say, is that people don't only focus on these parts of the world when there are security issues or when there's political violence. And the United States in particular adopt more focus and pay more attention to West Africa, the Sahel, to North Africa as an area rather than just as a site for, say, counterterrorism training and equipment, and that they don't just see this part of the world as a potential area of threat or an arc of instability, as some people have called it, but that people take a much broader view of this part of the world in particular.
Well, those are good points. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you.
Thank you.